3 weeks ago, I began a series on the wisdom of Proverbs. And if we turn over to Daniel chapter 12, because we went there initially when I was beginning the actual series and giving that sermon over in Daniel chapter 12, because it is an important subject for this particular juncture of history, the time of the end, as we're approaching the time of the end. Daniel 12 certainly brings this out. In verse 9 it says, and he says, "Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end." So the understanding of this particular passage wasn't understood by Mr. Armstrong even when he first started preaching the truth. It wasn't until several years down the line until he actually started to understand this particular area of scripture. And it's interesting that it says in verse 4, "But you, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end." And then he gives an identifying sign for that time, that many shall run to and fro and knowledge shall be increased. Certainly when you're looking at running to and fro, just my voice being carried across the internet to all the people listening to it now is an indication of that. The communications are such that we've never, ever had before at all. And scientific advancement of knowledge is quite remarkable. But it's interesting that in looking at the world, you've got this incredible fund of knowledge that is there, but the wisdom and the understanding that goes with it, or should go with it, isn't there. Because it goes on in verse 10, it says, "Many shall be purified and made white," talking of the church now, "many shall be purified, made white, and tried." And we are in a time of testing right now. But at this time, when we're being made white and tried and tested and being measured as far as Revelation 11 is talking about the temple to which Christ is going to return, the wicked shall do wickedly and none of the wicked shall understand. So there's going to be a progressive burden of wickedness in the world at large. But, it says, the wise shall understand. And this is what really means that we really do need to keep a handle on wisdom, and certainly the place to go for wisdom. And as I pointed out last time, you look at the world and there is a certain degree of wisdom there. The great train robbers was what I brought out as an example. The great train robbers, they certainly had wisdom. They planned, they had the knowledge of the fact that the mail train held the money, that was the knowledge that came through. The understanding that, okay, if they did certain things that they could therefore highlight that particular area of the train, and the wisdom to actually go and plan the details of actually carrying out the raid and actually extracting the money for themselves. But it wasn't godly wisdom, and the key area that we need to understand, that when we're looking at the book of Proverbs, we're looking at the wisdom of God. It's God's wisdom that is so important, as it says in James 3, as I read last time, that wisdom from above is first pure. And it's got to be pure as far as the Holy Spirit is concerned. It's coming from a certain source. It's not just the wise of this world. It's the wisdom that is coming from God. It's a wisdom that's coming from godly wise ones. And I was talking about how the wisdom comes from God and the fact that God is the creator. And we look in the natural world and we see the creation and we see an enormous amount of wisdom. I mean, you look at something like the kingfisher. Apparently there's a kingfisher around here that's on the river. I've never seen a kingfisher. It's something I would like to actually see. But you look at the bright colors on the kingfisher. As far as I know, it's not the iridescence quite the same as you find on the butterfly wing. A butterfly wing is not coloured. It's actually to do with the actual refraction of light. Whereas you look at the bird wings, then they are actually coloured, as I understand it. But the Creator actually made these things with great wisdom, with great forethought, and with the understanding that we would look at the multitude of created life forms and marvel at the multitude of created life forms, and planted us in that. And he placed man in a garden, he placed man in the natural world to be able to see what he is like. And we learn a great deal of what he's like. And that same individual, as I pointed out in Isaiah 11, verse 2, where the spirit of wisdom and understanding on Jesus Christ as far as the world tomorrow is concerned, that's what's going to be bringing about the world tomorrow. And the wisdom of the Creator himself will bring about the world tomorrow and cause that same wisdom to be applied to the world of man and give man salvation for the first time and allow him to understand what he needs to understand. And it is now, he is now creating that same wisdom. He should be creating that same wisdom in each of us, in you and in me, because we're going to need it. We're going to be working with him, and we're going to be working with him in that same kind of wisdom. So we need to ask for it. So when we're looking at the wisdom of God, it's something we need to ask for, something we need to go to God for. And it says in James 1 verse 5, to any lack wisdom, let him ask of God and he'll be given to him. And certainly that is something that we need to do on a regular basis, quite frankly. But then we looked at the structure of Proverbs, because Proverbs, in fact, wasn't isn't something that is, although it's put together by Solomon, it wasn't, they weren't all written by Solomon. Solomon actually gathered them together. And we find in chapters 1 to 9 very ancient gatherings of writings. Goes back to many hundreds of years before, if not thousands of years before Solomon. And then you get, starting with chapter 10, you start with actually the Proverbs of Solomon himself. And that goes all the way down to chapter 22. And in chapter 22 to chapter 24, we find a group of Proverbs from the wise ones, but they're special wise ones. They're the wise ones that came out of Egypt, because they actually discovered them written on papyri, which were found back in 1910, and they're almost word for word, being brought out of Egypt. So you're looking at these particular segment that came from Egypt, Egyptian wise ones, probably Joseph. Then chapter 24, you find some additional wise comments that from additional wise ones. Then you then find more of Solomon's proverbs in chapters 25 to 29, but these were added by Hezekiah later on, rather than be lost, because it was part of the canonization period of Hezekiah, and they were added at that particular time. Then you got the words of Agur in chapter 30, and finally Lemuel's mother. It may well have been, if Lemuel was Solomon, then it would be Bathsheba that gave the instruction to the kings. And so you have this division. And if we go over to Ecclesiastes 12, we find what Solomon says towards the end of his life in Ecclesiastes, looking at the collection of the Proverbs. And here in verse 9 it says, "And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs." So that's where they actually came from. He sought out and set them in order. He organized them, and he wrote 3,000 proverbs, was it? And also we find 900 in the book of Proverbs itself. And then the songs as well that he wrote, 1,000 songs. "But the preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. The words of the wise ones," it literally means, it literally means the wise ones, it's wise individuals, "are all as goads and as nails fastened by the master of assemblies, and are given from one shepherd." So this is what indicates that what he was seeking out were not just merely wise sayings, some wise sayings from the great train robberies or something like that. I mean, that's not what he's looking for. He was looking for the wisdom of God, which was expressed by men of God. And this is what he put together, "given from one shepherd. And furthermore, by these words, given from one shepherd, my son, be admonished." And so it's something that we all need to do, is to be admonished by them and to actually put them to heart. So those are the areas that we went into last time. And what I'd like to do today, I'd like to get into the book probably a little bit more, to some degree anyway. First of all, to go into the first actual proverb that we'll find within the book of Proverbs, which is the fear of the eternal is the beginning of wisdom, a beginning of knowledge. Let's read it. Let's go to Proverbs itself, because there's actually different proverbs, but the one that is actually kicks off the book of Proverbs in verse 7 of chapter 1. It says, the fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. You also find the fear of the eternal is the beginning of wisdom as well. And there are various forms of this particular proverb, but it gives the basis, it gives the foundation, it gives the start of the entire subject. And I'd like to look at that and have a look and make sure that foundation is firm within our minds. Now, secondly, what I want to do is to talk about seeking wisdom. Now, not just seeking wisdom, it's seeking wisdom to be like our father, to be like our elder brother. And you find that within the book of Proverbs, like verse 8 here of Proverbs 1, it says, my son, hear the instruction of your father and forsake not the law of your mother. And God talks to us actually as sons and daughters. He uses the term my son continually. And it's interesting that when you look at the Rehoboam, his son didn't really take much notice of what he actually had to say. But it is very much a case of seeking wisdom. And we'll actually start going through the book itself, and through the first seven chapters, and notice just how many times this word, you know, my son, and gives a certain information addressed to you as a son of God, a potential son of God, both male and female. We're potential sons of God that are going to be the children of God in the future. But then if we get time, which I personally doubt, but if we get time, we'll maybe touch on the materialism. I'd like to kick that off, because let's face it, we're looking at Laodicea. What's the problem with Laodicea? Well, they're rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing. Therefore, they have need of no wisdom. No wisdom that's necessary at all. In fact, they are poor, blind, miserable, and naked, and therefore desperately need the wisdom that this book has. So the first thing we need to look at is getting materialism in the right place, because that seems to be the problem. When the eternal, when Christ returns to this earth, will he find faith in the earth? Again, where's that come from? It comes from a materialistic view of life. The more materialistic we are, the less faith we have. And it has an impact on our healing, quite frankly. Healing within the church is impacted by the lack of faith, by the increase in materialism. So that subject, and getting a handle, having a wise view of that, is certainly a very important aspect that we'll need to look into. And that's about as far as we'll ever get in this particular section. So we'll leave it at that, because when you start going through the book of Proverbs, there are so many different ways to slice it, so many different ways of going through it. And one proverb will actually talk in several different ways, whether it's to do with wisdom, whether it's to do with sexual immorality, whatever it might be. At the basis, just before we go into the section on the fear of God, and the fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge, and this particular initial proverb that's given in the book of Proverbs in chapter 1, it's important that we start to understand and really grasp what the difference between knowledge, understanding, and wisdom is. And if you want to, I would say that the key really revolves around understanding. If you want to try and remember the difference. So knowledge is pretty well self-explanatory. It's facts. It also includes theories and ideas as well, but basically it's facts of all different kinds. It's the raw information. Understanding, however, how do you define understanding? Well, it's within the word. What does the word mean? It's understanding. It's what stands under something. It's the foundation. It's what really lies behind something. It's its base. It's the foundation behind the facts. It's what stands under the facts. It's what allows you to understand, to grasp those facts properly, because you start to understand what is lying behind them, what is undergirding them, what is actually supporting them, the aspects that support all these facts and raw information. And that's the understanding that is there. But the wisdom is to do with the best course of action taken from that understanding, from the facts that you've got. What kind of direction of life are you going to take your actions from that point forward? How best to do, to walk, to operate, to think, due to the understanding gained? And that therefore gives you the wisdom. The wisdom is, understanding gives you the basis of things. But wisdom then allows you to take that basis and apply it to life, to real life situations. And the true source of all this, of both understanding and wisdom, it comes from God himself. It comes from God himself, because there is an understanding, there is a wisdom. As I said, the great train robbers had understanding, they had wisdom from the facts that the knowledge that they'd gained of the mail train. But it was going in a certain direction, which was very unwise, and they did not understand the end result of their actions, which was that they'd be on the run from the police for the rest of their lives, and basically it didn't work out the way that they intended at all. So we see here in chapter 1 of Proverbs, we read the introduction statements, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, the king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice and judgment and equity, to give subtlety to the simple, to the young man, and notice to the young man particularly, to those of us that have gone through teenage, these things steer. Because let's face it, when you've lived a few decades, then you've burnt your fingers, you've done things which really you realize were not very wise. But the young have never done that. They've never actually gone ahead and had their fingers burned. And it gives you the wisdom, it gives subtlety to the simple, and to the young man, knowledge and discretion, knowing where you should tread and where you shouldn't tread. And that is such a vitally important subject. A wise man will hear and will increase learning, and a man of understanding shall attain unto wise counsel. In other words, even somebody who is elderly, who has gone ahead and burned his fingers, who has gone ahead and has a certain degree of understanding and wisdom, this book is going to give you yet more. It's going to allow you to expand on that, to extend that. To understand a proverb and the interpretation of the words of the wise ones and their dark sayings. And again, the things that Solomon sought out came from one shepherd. It was the ones, the wise ones, yes, but they were coming from the from God himself. And then it comes to this next verse in verse 7. And verse 7 gives you the basis of the entire book. It gives you the first proverb of the entire book, and that then gives you the basis of the entire book. That the fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge, which, if you like, kicks off the understanding, which kicks off the wisdom. So the beginning of knowledge, the beginning of putting together any kind of understanding, any kind of knowledge, is from the fear of God, from the fear of the eternal. But fools, contrasting it, despise wisdom and instruction. They despise wisdom, they despise understanding. And so I would strongly recommend that you, if you've got a marker, certainly put a marker in Proverbs, because we'll be coming back there as well. In fact, I'll be getting myself a marker in there. But let's turn back to Job. Chapter 28. Job 28. And this is Job speaking. And he holds to his righteousness in verse 6 of the preceding chapter. And into verse 28, he talks about God and how the things that he does. And then you finally come to verse 28, and he says, "And unto man he said, Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and depart from evil, that's understanding." Now, it's the fear of the Lord, fear of the eternal. It is actually saying the Lord here, it's not the eternal. But the fear of God, that's wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. And it says over in Proverbs 1, verse 7, the fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge. It kicks the whole thing off. It undergirds it. And it is. Notice how he links together in verse 28 of Job 28. He links together the fear of the Lord, yes, but he also links together to depart from evil. The way in which you fear God, the way in which that is done, is departing from evil. Now, there's two different levels And if you you can get books on the Book of Proverbs written by outside people who are not converted, and yet there's quite a great deal of understanding you'll find within them. And to the degree that they apply the things that are in the book, they will gain understanding themselves, they'll gain wisdom, they'll gain knowledge from the book, as far as their carnal mind can understand. But you and I, within the church, should be able to go further. And so there's really two different levels, if you like, of reading the book. One is a level that you'll find on the outside, and you'll find that if they fear God, if they have a fear of God, and people do, and let's face it, Romans 1, they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. They hide the fact that there is a God, and they are going to be held accountable for that. It's not a case that people can look. You all you have to do is look out at the natural world, and you can see a wisdom, you can see an understanding, you can see intelligent design, as I've mentioned many times, as far as the understanding is concerned. Everybody on earth should be able to be held to account on that score. Everybody should be held to account. You know, the survival of the fittest. You find an evolution, a micro-evolution, does take place within the natural world. That is true. You know, you find the survival of the fittest. The fittest will survive, and the ones that are not fit will die, because the fittest are able to have, there's a limited amount of food, and this is the way it works. But it's not the origin of species, because the fittest, you've got to have the fittest there in order to survive. The fittest aren't produced by the survival of the fittest. The origin of species is not produced by the survival of the fittest. Because survival of the fittest are there, they're already created. It's mutation that they're saying. By mutation, new life forms come into existence. That you don't find in the natural world. That is not the case. The fittest have got to be there in order to survive. It's not the survival of the fittest, it's the arrival of the fittest, as people have said. And so people looking at the natural world, they should be able to see that. They should be able to see that, you know, an eye is designed. And for a random generated DNA to be able to produce that, you don't just have the changes within the area of the DNA that produces the eye. You'll have mutations throughout the rest of the genome as well. And if you mutate too much, then you'll mutate in these other areas as well. And you'll destroy the individual. You'll destroy the actual life form. And you can't do that. It's not just the little bit that changes and the statistical probability of that little bit changing. It's the fact that all the other bits have got to remain viable. And you put those two together and the numbers go off the scale. They go off the astronomic scale. They go beyond, you know, 10 to the power of 2 million for a bacteria. This kind of order. And I'm not talking about, to the power. I'm talking to the power of 2 million. In other words, a one with 2 million zeros after it. You know, if you get every atom in the universe combining and separating from the Big Bang till now, you only get 10 to the power of about 130. And yet this is 10 to the power of 2 million for the simplest E. coli bacteria. And as I say, you change certain parts of it, the rest of it has got to remain viable. It's got to remain intact. Because if you make the change too big, and yet it's got to be right in the right place. You know, the retina cannot suddenly appear on some animal's backside. It just doesn't work there. It's got to work in the right place at the right time. It's got to be generated at the right time. It's got to grow through puberty. You know, this is intelligence design. And anyone with half a brain should be able to see with the natural world that didn't happen by chance. And so when we're looking at the Book of Proverbs, there are levels, there are degrees. The fear of the eternal, the fear of the creating God, that is something that all mankind should have. And if you don't have it, you're a fool. You're a fool. And this is what happens, as it says over here. The fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. They despise the very eternal that gives them the knowledge, that allows them to able to look out and see and recognize where it's actually come from. And that wisdom, that fear of the Lord, which is wisdom, it also involves departing from evil. That's where your understanding comes from. Because it steers you away from what God, this being, defines as evil. And as I say, you go into the natural world, and you should be able to see that something like homosexuality, for instance, it isn't going anywhere. It doesn't produce anything. It doesn't do anything. It shouldn't be, it should be legislated against. And yet fools, as it says here, fools despise wisdom and instruction. They don't look at the natural world. They don't see the natural world as coming from a creating God. And therefore, they have despised wisdom and instruction. And the end result is chaos, which we find within society. Turn over to Psalm 19. Psalm 19. And here you see how the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork, and day to day utters speech, and night to night shows knowledge. You look out into the vastness of space, and you see the design that is even within there, and the galaxies, and the way that the laws work, the way that there was some kind of Big Bang. It wasn't necessarily the singularity. The evidence, the background radiation, is there. Now, the only thing is, what they therefore say, they start saying, well, what in fact happened is that it's like a piece of elastic. It expands and it contracts, it expands and contracts, and it's been doing it forever. Well, there's no evidence of that at all. The word singularity means singular. It's one singularity. It's not multiple singularity. They are not multiverses in a singularity. Singularity is singular, and that is all the evidence that they find. It is a pure concoction. It is purely to support the faith of the atheist to have a multiverse. There is no evidence for a multiverse. And if you look at the heavens and you look at them correctly and you see the fine tuning that is there, then you see the heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament shows his handiwork. Day to day utters speech, and night to night shows knowledge. You point your telescopes out there, and you look out there, and you see a singularity. And that is the one universe with a clear, definitive beginning, because everything is flying out from each other. So you bring everything back to a single point, and there is your beginning. And that, at that point, all your equations break down. But I personally remember talking to an astrophysicist and asking her and saying, look, would the same background radiation have occurred if the whole thing came into existence immediately? If the whole thing was created in one, just in one act? And she backed away. She wouldn't even entertain the thought. She just kept on saying, well, multiverses explain the relationship to me. And she wouldn't even answer my question. But I feel absolutely confident that if it is indicated, the whole thing comes into existence in one command and it suddenly comes into existence, you imagine that happening and the vibration that would come from that. The vibration would be huge. It would be just the same as a Big Bang. And the vibration also would have the same mottling effect that you find within the background radiation. The mottling effect of they say they cannot explain that through a Big Bang. You have an explosion. Do you have an explosion that is mottled with the patterns of galaxies? Where do you get this mottling from? Well, they say it's exploded from outside of another singularity, another universe. And they have these multiple universes, and then they come up with these ideas where you go, if you walk out this door and you go left, in some universe, some being will be walking out the door and going right. And, they try and just get around the statistics. The statistics scream at you saying, look, you cannot have this fine tuning. You cannot have what we see. And it's the evidence. The heavens declare the glory of God. And the firmament show his handiwork. And you can look out there and you can see this. And here in verse 9, it says, in verse 7, the law of the Eternal is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Eternal is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Eternal are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandments of the Eternal are pure, enlightening the eyes. All these aspects are coming from his mind, the same mind that made the heavens, the same mind that created all things. The fear of the Eternal is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Eternal are true and righteous altogether. And more to be desired are they than gold, yet much finer than fine gold, sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb, and by them is your servant warned, and keeping them is great reward. And this is what you find. This is what you find over in Proverbs 1, where it says, the fear of the Eternal is the beginning of knowledge. It's what underlies it. It's, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God. It's when you have the fear of God and the fear of a creator, you look at the heavens in a certain way, and the knowledge that comes in a certain way. And that knowledge is true knowledge, is right knowledge. But fools despise the wisdom and the instruction that the natural world will give them, if they open their eyes and if they see it for what it really is. It is a singularity, a singular universe. That is all the evidence that we have. And the only way it can exist is there is an intelligent designer. Anything else is a fabrication. You know, multiverses are a fabrication by the atheist to justify a position. There's no evidence that gives them that. There's evidence of another world of some description in certain equations to do with the electron. But it's another world. It's probably the spirit world. Probably the spirit world, which you find again within this book. But and it says in verse 9 of Psalm 19, the fear of the Eternal is clean, enduring forever. It'll take us right the way through into eternity. The judgments of the Eternal are true, and they're righteous altogether. If we go over to Psalm 111, Psalm 111, again, there are many facets of this concept, that the fear of the Eternal is the beginning of knowledge. Yes, it's the beginning of many, many things. It spreads out. It's almost like a facet of a jewel. And that really is true. And you find that. These are my jewels. When I make my jewels in Malachi, we'll read that. And it has certain facets. There's a certain wisdom. And the wisdom to the wise will understand. But the wicked will do wickedly. And none of the wicked will understand. Why? Well, because they don't have the fear of the Eternal. They don't have the fear of God. This is the basis, the bedrock of it. And here in Psalm 111, you find it again in verse 10. It says, the fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom. So not only is it the beginning of knowledge, which underlies the understanding, which underlies the wisdom, it's the beginning of wisdom as well, obviously, because it's underlying the knowledge that produces the wisdom. And a good understanding have all they that actually do his commandments. His praise endures forever. And his praise does. You look at the things that are made. And as Mr. Armstrong brings out, it says in verse 7, it says, the works of his hands are verity and judgment. All his commandments are sure. With his finger, he wrote on the two tables of stone the Ten Commandments. And those commandments, he says, and all his commandments are sure. Those commandments summarize and sum up the thinking of God as it applies to human beings. The thinking of God, that the Torah is the way. It is the way of life. It's the law. The law or the Torah is the way of life. But the commandments are the phrases, the words that define and describe that way. There are two basic commandments, love towards God and love towards man. And of those two then go out into the Ten Commandments that we find written on, as it says here, the work of his hands of truth and judgment, and that all his commandments are sure. They stand fast forever and ever, and they're done in truth and uprightness. He sends redemption to his people. He's commanded his covenant forever. Holy and reverend is his name, and the fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom. And a good understanding have all they that do his commandments, because it'd be the context of it actually. The Hebrew says that do. that are active. A good understanding of all those that are doing it, but they're doing it according to the fear of the Eternal. They're doing it with the wisdom. They're doing it according to the commandments, which, because the context of the entire passage here is so, the entire psalm, the entire song, is to do with his commandments. And certainly keeping those commandments is so vital. Another one that you can look at is over in Proverbs chapter 9. Proverbs chapter 9. In Proverbs 9, it says, "Reprove not a scorner, lest he hate you. Rebuke a wise man, he'll love you," in verse 8. And in verse 9, it says, "Give instruction to a wise man, he will be yet wiser, and a just man, and he will increase in learning. Because the fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy is understanding." Now, when you start to really understand what it means, when it talks about the knowledge of the Holy, and you start to really grasp how that can apply. Let's just turn over to 1 Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. The knowledge of the Holy is understanding, and the knowledge of the Holy gives us the understanding that we need, quite frankly. And notice what it says here in 1 Thessalonians 4. It says in verse 13, it says, "I would not have you ignorant, brethren." So the knowledge of the Holy. And we have a knowledge of what? We have the knowledge of the Holy Days. The knowledge of the Holy Days, just notice what it does. "I wouldn't have you be ignorant, brethren, concerning those which are asleep, that you sorrow not, or even as others which have no hope." Why do we have hope? Because we have a knowledge of the Holy. Knowledge of the Holy Days and the outline of the plan of God gives us a knowledge of what life is all about, a knowledge of what in fact happens when we die, a knowledge of what happens to, as Mr. Armstrong was saying with Chiang Kai-shek, what happens to all these millions and billions of Chinese that have never heard, or Indians that have never heard the name of Jesus Christ, when it says clearly that there's no other name under heaven by which man can be saved. What happens to them? Well, again, we understand that. Why? Because of the Holy Days. Because we have a knowledge of the Holy. "But I would not have you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those which are asleep, that you sorrow not even as others that have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so those which sleep in Jesus will God bring with him. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive and remain to the coming of the Lord shall not precede those which are asleep. For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, with a trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. And then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we shall ever be with the Lord. Therefore comfort one another with these words. But of the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write to you." Why? Because we have a knowledge of the Holy. A knowledge of the Holy gives understanding. "So you have no need that I write to you. For you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness that the day should overtake you as a thief." How do we know these things? Because of the knowledge of the Holy. And it goes and it starts with a fear of the Eternal, as it says, "The fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy is understanding." That's what gives us the understanding when we really grasp it. And it starts with the fear of God. You have the right kind of fear of God. You come before God. You are given an open mind. God opens our mind and allows us to have this knowledge of the things which are holy. "But you, brethren, are not in darkness that the day should overtake you as a thief. But you're all the children of light, and the children of the day were not of the night nor of darkness. Therefore let us not sleep as others, but let us watch and be sober." So we see very clear here that this understanding that we have of the actual plan of God the resurrection, where that fits, how the actual Day of Trumpet fits, how the fact that we shouldn't be have sorrow as others that have no hope. And the only reason we are able to do that is that we have a knowledge of the holy. We have a knowledge of the holy days. It says in chapter 9 of Proverbs, verse 10, the fear of the eternal is the beginning of wisdom. And it's the godly wisdom. It's the kind of wisdom that God has. And the knowledge of the holy is understanding. Now, if you go back to Psalm 111 again, should have gone from there. Psalm 111. The works of his hands are verity and judgment, and all his commandments are sure, verse 7. And they stand fast forever and ever, and are done in truth and uprightness. And the fear of the eternal is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all they that actually do his commandments. So those commandments are actually being done. Now, if there's one chapter in the entire Bible that gives us the understanding that we need regarding the law of God and the ways of God and the commandments specifically, it's Psalm 119. Psalm 119. And the wisdom that is in there and the understanding that is gained. Notice what it says in chapter 111. The fear of the eternal is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all those that do his commandments, do his judgments, do what he wants. That's basically what you're really implying. The word his commandments is actually added there by the translators. But the implication is by the context that it's true. But it's not just his commandments, i.e. the Ten Commandments. It's whatever is required by God, by this being, the eternal that is the beginning of wisdom. And when we look here in Psalm 119, let's look in verse 27, and just notice how much the word understanding. It says, make me to understand the way of your precepts, so that I talk of your wondrous works. It's not just knowing them, it's the understanding of them as well. In verse 34, it says, give me understanding, and I will keep your law, your Torah, your way of life, with the understanding as well. Remember what understanding is. It's understanding. It's a foundation. It's what stands under the knowledge. So you've got the knowledge, which is the law of God, which is the Torah, which is the way of life. And it's expressed in Ten Commandments. But the understanding is what stands underneath it. It's the foundation. It gives us the foundation. Give me understanding, and I will keep your law. Yes, I'll observe it with my whole heart. That's where it's coming from. It comes from the heart. It's the only way to actually keep God's law. To keep God's law, and in the sense that when Christ was asked, "What good thing must I do to inherit eternal life?" He says, "Well, you know the commandments. Keep the commandments." That you've got to keep the commandments God's way, with the understanding, with what in fact lies behind them. And it says in verse 66. It says, teach me good judgments and knowledge, for I have received your commandments. So you receive the commandments, but in addition to that, you need the judgment to go with it, and you need the knowledge to go with it as well. Without that knowledge and judgment, then it's not going to really take root. In verse 73, your hands have made me and fashioned me. Give me understanding that I may learn your commandments. So the creating God has made us physically and created us. But more than that, we now need to be created spiritually. We now need to have the mental creation that is found within the entirety of life. And this is why it says, give me the understanding that I may learn your commandments and learn the basis, the root, what is understanding or standing under those commandments. In verse 98, notice. In verse 98, you through your commandments have made me wiser than my enemies, for they are ever with me. How I love you. We sing this. So how I love you, I love the Lord. It's my meditation all the day. Why? Because you, through your commandments, have made me wiser than my enemies, because they are ever with me. Once you have those commandments, those words, those phrases that express the law, the Torah, the way of God, the way we should be walking, then we, and if we go, actually go down that way, that route, then we will have the wisdom that is, again, wiser than your enemies. Verse 99, and I have more understanding than all my teachers, for your testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the ancients, because I keep your precepts. And this, again, rests very much on the phrase that we find back in Psalm 111, that the fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom, but a good understanding have all they that do, that actually do, that operate. And this entire psalm lays out this fact. I've refrained my feet from every evil way in verse 101, and I may keep your word. I will not depart from your judgments, for you have taught me. How sweet are your words to my taste, yes, sweeter than honey to my mouth. Through your precepts I get understanding, therefore I hate every false way. You know, when you're going through a maze, if you go through a maze and you take a false way, what happens? Well, you end up in a dead end. You go round several corners, and you finally end up at the dead end. You've got to go all the way back again and start and go and do it right. It's like if you're building a house, and you start building the house, and you just put the foundation down any old house, and then what happens? Well, you get up onto the second floor, and the thing's leaning. It happened to somebody with a leaning Tower of Pisa. I think what happened there was it actually sank. It sank on one side. But they didn't have the foundation right. You don't get the foundation right, and therefore that whole thing starts leaning over. But it says, through your precepts I get understanding, therefore I hate every false way. I can see what is a false way. So from the Proverbs of Solomon, they're not Proverbs of Solomon, it's the Proverbs of God. And it says, the fear of the Eternal is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. And wisdom and instruction comes from the very understanding that we get from, that it says here in Psalm 119, where it gives the indication that you hate every false way. So it directs the steps, the way forward. Verse 125, I'm your servant. Give me understanding that I may know your testimonies. So I really may know and understand and hang on to those testimonies. Verse 130. The entrance of your words gives light. It gives understanding to the simple. And again, when you're looking at the book of Proverbs, this is the same thing, that the Proverbs give the understanding that's necessary. Verse 144. The righteousness of your testimony is everlasting. Give me understanding and I shall live. And so repeatedly you find the level of understanding. I mean, what kind of understanding will it give you? Well, let me just read something from a Saga magazine. And does it give the right understanding? Does it give the right way? Does it give the right direction? Well, the direction that this particular editor, I think editor-in-chief, isn't she? It says, but talking about Kate and William and Catherine, Prince William and Catherine Middleton, as they were then. But I take my hat off to them and to Prince William in particular, because he didn't give in to what must have been almost unbearable pressure to make an honest woman of his girlfriend before he was good and ready. In enjoying a relationship for 8 years before marrying, Prince William and Catherine typify the way in which young couples now approach the altar. This school of courtship sees a young lovebird spending years together before walking up the aisle. They take the prospect of marriage much more seriously than many of our generation, whose subsequent record in the divorce court is world-beating. So the answer to the world-beating divorce figures, don't get married. Live together. That's the answer. You know, you only get married when you're really, 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 really absolutely sure. Some young couples even live through the seven-year itch and split up perhaps several times before finally committing to marriage. And why is this? I suspect they've looked at their parents' marriages and decided that they would rather risk losing a relationship in which they're much invested rather than make the same mistakes. Is that valid? Is that wise? As I say, through your precepts, I get understanding. Therefore, I hate every false way. You should be able to see that that is a false way. You have another, this is from an article, what date was this? Tuesday, January the 14th this year. But it says, marriage beats living together for happiness. It says basically that married couples are happier than those that live together. A major state-funded study said yesterday, found that even though husbands and wives have greater doubts than the unmarried couples about the quality of their relationships, they are more content than cohabitees. When asked if they are happy with their lives overall, married couples rate themselves much happier than the other couples do. The Enduring Love study, produced by the Open University, said mothers were the happiest people of all. And you, again... How do you rate this? How do you understand? How do you get wisdom in this? Well, you basically go to the law of God, and what does the law of God indicate? And when I say law, I mean Torah. I mean the way of God. I don't mean just a commandment that you go to and you tick off because you say, well, the commandment says you shall not commit adultery. Therefore, if you don't get married, it doesn't count. Well, that's not the way it works. If you go ahead and you look at what God's intent was, his intent was for a man and a woman. If he wanted several men and several women to live in cohabiting, then he would have made it like that. He would have made a commune. He didn't. He made a man and a woman with their children. That is a family. Whatever the leaders may say, that is a family with their children. And there's a wisdom there. Where does the wisdom come from? From a fear of the one who made the Torah, the law. And it's not, as I say, it's not just a bunch of commandments you go down and you tick off. It is the fact that you try and get to God's mindset. And therefore it says, through your precepts, I get understanding. Therefore I hate every false way. Therefore I'm steered in a certain direction. This is what the fear of the eternal is. This is what it says when it says the fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge. But fools despise wisdom and instruction. There is so much, I mean, we've taken that one verse and expanded it and expanded it. That you see the wisdom, understanding, and the knowledge, and how it applies. You know, just look. If you've got a computer and you just put the word judgment in into this Psalm 119 and search Psalm just the word judgment in Psalm 119. I haven't actually counted how many there are here. There must be something like 30 different cases of judgment, because wisdom is making the right judgments. That's what wisdom is. It's making judgments of the direction that we need to go based on the right knowledge and the right understanding. And the knowledge, you know, the fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge, is the beginning of the entire process. You get that right, the rest then follows. I mean, let's look at some of these. Let's just look at a few of them. In Psalm 119, verse 7, I will praise you with uprightness of heart when I have learned your righteous judgments. Why? It's Psalm 119, verse 7. Why? Because if he, whatever his righteous judgments are, that's the way David wants to go. Verse 13. With my lips have I declared all your judgments of your mouth. Why is that? Well, because what's coming out of his mouth reflects the mindset that makes the right judgment. And what's the direction of the judgments? Well, the wisdom of God. It's the wisdom of God, and it's the fear of God as well. Verse 20, my soul breaks for the longing that it has unto your judgments at all times. It wants to make the judgments and the right decisions in life. That's where the wisdom's coming from. It's coming from the same mindset that produces the judgment. You come to a fork in the road, in a maze, and do you go right, do you go left? Well, this is what it's talking about. This is why it says the fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge. But fools despise wisdom and instruction. They don't take that. They don't take it on board. And you can go through, you know, as I say, do it in your own time. But just take the word judgment. go through Psalm 119, and it's repeated over and over and over again. And each judgment being made, David is saying that he wants to make judgments the way God makes judgments. And you know, seven times a day do I praise you because of your righteous judgments. Why? Because seven times and more a day, he's having to make judgments himself. He's a king, remember. He's making judgments himself based on that wisdom. Based on that wisdom. He's coming to a fork in the road, and he says, do I go left and do I go right? He doesn't need a Urim and a Thummim. He basically goes back to the wisdom, the fear of the Eternal. The fear of the Eternal that gives him the basis. And there are several areas like that that we could look at. But let's just have a look at some other scriptures in this section. Whether we'll actually get any more than this section, I'm not sure. But let's go to Ecclesiastes again. And just notice how Solomon ends the book of Ecclesiastes. Because he says, in verse 13, it says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. And what's the conclusion of the whole matter? And the whole book of Ecclesiastes is a carnal approach to wisdom and vanity of vanity, all is vanity. Because all it is, when you look at the flesh, there's nothing much. You can be as wise as you like. If you don't have, if you're not resurrected, then you remain rotting in the ground. But let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole man. That's the conclusion that he came to. And just in the same way, what's he doing when he kicks off the book of Proverbs, which gives us wisdom? The fear of the Eternal is the beginning of knowledge that undergirds the whole process. But fools despise wisdom and instruction. And as we've read over in Psalm 111, it's the knowledge of the holy. And sorry, it's keeping the commandments. And in Proverbs 9:10, the knowledge of the holy. And you can see how all of these things fit together. Let's turn over to Malachi chapter 3. Malachi chapter 3. Talking again, right down at the end time. And we find here in verse 16, then they that feared the Eternal spoke often one with another. And we should be communicating with one another. And the Eternal listened and heard it, and the book of remembrance was written before him of those that feared the Eternal and that thought upon his name. As I said before, you look at, Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. The mind that is that we see within this natural world is astounding, absolutely astounding. And you think upon his name, that's his authority, that's his name, his authority. And the name also being used here is Yahweh. The word Lord or Eternal is Yahweh. It's the ever-living one. It's the one that was, that is, that will be. The one who made all things through his word. And that word is personified. It's Jesus Christ. And that word is, he and the Father created, that thought up all that we see. It is an astounding world, astounding fact that there is anything here at all, that we can sit here or stand here, and I can talk and I can use the natural world to transmit my voice across the oceans. And it is an astounding world. It's all resting on the word of God, all resting on his laws. And it says, a book of remembrance was written before him of those that feared the Eternal. And so therefore they were the wise ones, they were the ones that had wisdom. He says, the wicked will do wickedly, but none of the wicked will understand, but the wise will understand. And in this world that we have an incredible amount of knowledge is increased, rushing to and fro with communications, and with that scientific knowledge increased. But the understanding, what stands under everything, is being lost. The God that actually is behind everything is being pushed to one side continually. Therefore, the understanding isn't there. And neither is the wisdom, because it's only through the understanding that you get the wisdom. And so, but these individuals here, a book of remembrance written before him of those that feared the Eternal properly, so there had to be part of the church, and thought upon his name, and they shall be mine, says the Eternal of Hosts, in the day when I make up my jewels. And as I say, wisdom is a multifaceted thing. It gives even that one proverb that is the fear of the Eternal. It's a multifaceted concept, and it's almost like a jewel. I'll make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spares his own son that serves him. And then shall you return and discern between the righteous and the wicked. Why? Because you can understand. You have the wisdom to be able to apply in that situation. Why? Because you fear God and you keep his commandments. This is the whole man. This is what it's talking about. Between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serves God and him that serves him not. So we see that being a crucial ingredient as far as the end time is concerned. Let's turn over to John chapter 8. John chapter 8. Before we do that, let's turn over to Luke 18. Luke 18, before we go down to John 8. Because this particular thinking on his name, thinking on just what being we have and that we're actually dealing with, fearing the Eternal, it does involve thinking on his name. And it says in chapter 18, verse 1, he says, he spoke a parable to them to this end, that men should always pray and not to faint, saying, there was in a city a judge which feared not God, neither regarded man. And there was a widow in the city, that she came unto him, saying, avenge me of my adversary. And he wouldn't for a while, but afterwards he said within himself, though I fear not God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by a continual coming she weary me. And the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge said. So he's saying, and the context of that verse is very much the end time. The end of chapter 17, it talks about remembering Lot's wife in verse 32. It talks about whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses it, preserve it. And in that night there'll be two in one bed, there'll be two grinding at the mill in different times of day. One will be taken, the other left. And he says, where, Lord? And he says, wherever the eagles are gathered together. So it's to do with the fleeing, it's to do with the end time. You know, it says they ate and drank until Noah entered into the ark, and then the flood came. It's to do with the fleeing, it's to do with the end time. And at that time it says, hear what the unjust judge says. And he shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night to him, though he bear long with them. And this is the problem. You know, we need to speak often one with another, and we need to be fearing the Eternal and thinking on his name, which involves wisdom, which involves having understanding. And it says, and avenge his own elect, which cry day and night to him, though he bear long with them. And I tell you, he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth? There is going to be a problem with faith. And it is a problem. It is a problem within the church. Materialism is a real problem, and we'll deal with that more as we go on and understand. But the fear of the Eternal is a beginning of knowledge. It undergirds the knowledge that we have. You then get the understanding, the undergirding that knowledge. It leads to the understanding, it leads to the wisdom. And if we're not, if that isn't in place, then, you know, do we understand the magnitude of the individual that we have to deal with, or that is dealing with us? Do we really understand that individual? Let's turn over to John chapter 8 now, go where I was going before. And in verse 30 it says, and as he spoke these words, many believed on him. Now, Mr. Armstrong brings this out continually. But it's believing on him and believing him, believing what he says. So fearing the Eternal involves believing what he says, believing not just on him, not just fearing him as a cloudy entity somewhere, but fearing what he says. It's to do with his commandments, it's to do with the words that are there. As he spoke these words, many believed on him. And then he said to those Jews that believed on him, if you continue in my word, then you're my disciples indeed, And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And that's what the book of Proverbs is all about. If we turn over to Deuteronomy 4. And remember, when we're reading here in Deuteronomy 4, he's talking to carnal individuals, carnal human beings. But in Deuteronomy 4, it says, "Behold, I've taught you the statutes and judgments, even as the Eternal my God." That's verse 5. "Behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Eternal my God commanded me, that you should do so in the land where you should go in to possess it. And blessed are those that," you know, looking about doing the commandments, a good understanding of those that do his commandments. "Keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations that will hear of all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people." So even carnally speaking, we're looking at, you know, doing this, the commandments. And as I say, even when you're looking at the world as a whole, the world as a whole has a responsibility to recognize the creating God, the creator God, even though they don't understand the spiritual aspects, even though they're still carnal and they look at things carnally. There's a huge amount within Proverbs that applies to both, and we need to understand that. So when we, with our children, we should encourage our children to make sure that they do read the book of Proverbs, because it gives them wisdom. It gives them wisdom in life, how to actually make wise decisions regarding schoolwork, regarding relationships, not to get their fingers burnt in relationships, if they listen to what Proverbs have got to say, and certainly is full of wisdom. "But this is your wisdom." These words are the wisdom. What's it saying? Ecclesiastes. So the words of the wise ones are as goads, and as are nails fastened by the master of assemblies, the one who puts everything together. That's what it basically means. The master of assemblies, the master of the creation, the master who makes everything, who nails everything together, master of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd, coming from one shepherd. "And this," he says, "is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of all the nations that shall hear of all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. And they shall be mine, as the Eternal says, when I make up my jewels." And then you return and you discern between those that serve God and those that don't, those that are wise and those that aren't. You'll be able to steer the entire earth in a wise direction under the one who really is this master of assemblies, this one who is the one shepherd from which all these words that Solomon put together have flowed. And it says, "For what nation is there so great that has God so near them as the Eternal our God is in all things that we call upon him for? And what nation is there so great that has statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law which I set before you this day?" Now, if we go over to James chapter 1, again, thinking, the book of James is an interesting book. I know that although Luther did call it an epistle of straw, he called it that because it put so much emphasis on the law of God. That was the reason for it. But there's more to it than that. Other people have looked at it and they said, oh, it's disjointed. It goes here, it goes there, it goes everywhere. In fact, it doesn't. If you read it with an understanding hat on and see where it's actually ending up in chapter 5, it's ending up at healing. It's ending up at sickness. It's ending up at what, in fact, how our mind needs to approach the subject of healing. And unfortunately, we within the church, Christ said, when he returns, will he find faith on the earth? Will there really be faith? And the fact is that there isn't. Even within the church, there isn't. And, you know, we don't have the kind of healings today because there's the lack of faith. There is a distinct lack of faith within the church as a whole, within the world as a whole. We have a materialistic world. But the book of James deals with subjects, several subjects. It deals with the tongue, because the prayer of faith will save the sick. That's what it says. So what is coming out of your mouth? What's coming out of the minister's mouth that asks for a prayer of faith. What comes out of their mouth, because it says, pray one for another that you may be healed. What comes out of your mouth? And it says, the wisdom that's above is first pure. Is that what it is? Is it the way the entire chapter 3 deals with the tongue and the, well, what in fact comes out of our mouth? And it also deals with the trials that we go through. And it kicks off the entire book with the trials and with, in fact, asking for wisdom in handling those trials. So what kind of trials are we talking about? Many times we're talking about healing. We're talking about sicknesses. And therefore, you can read James in a certain way. Obviously, you can read it in many ways. You can read it the same way as you put a jigsaw together with all the other scriptures within the entirety of the Bible, which is the way we should be reading it. But it has a message within it to do with trials, to do with sicknesses particularly, and to do with healing. And here in verse 1 of chapter 1, James, a servant of God, of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes that are scattered abroad, greetings. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into different temptations, different trials, different type of trials. Knowing this, that the trying of your faith works patience. But let patience have a perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing, lacking nothing. So within the trials, one of the great lessons that we have within trials is the lesson of patience. It works patience, but it says allow that to happen, allow us to go through the trials and have the patience developed within that. Now, if any of you lack wisdom, what's the wisdom to all about? What's the wisdom in the trial? To handle the trial, how on earth we go through it. If you lack wisdom, then you ask of God that gives to all men liberally and upbraids not, and it shall be given to him. So we get on our knees and we ask for wisdom, and it's given. But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering, for he that wavers like a wave of the sea driven with the wind and tossed. In other words, you don't do it in, as it says in chapter 3, it says, the wisdom from above is first pure. Then it's peaceable, but it's got to be pure. And what's the context? The fountain sends forth the same place, sweet and bitter. Can a fig tree bear olive berries? You can't go two directions at the same time. It's got to come from the Holy Spirit itself. It's a holy breath that gives you that mouth, the kind of words that are necessary. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. But let him ask in faith, in verse 6 of chapter 1. Nothing wavering, for he that wavers is like a wave of the sea driven with the wind and tossed. And don't let that man think that he'll receive everything and anything of the Lord. If you're going in two directions at once, then how can you possibly receive something from God? A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. When you get on the knees and ask for wisdom, you ask for wisdom God's way. Now, what is it that you're actually asking for when you're asking for wisdom? What is it fundamentally? Well, you're asking basically for to understand the trials and the handles and put a handle on the trials that you're going through. But what you're asking for is a fear of God. You're asking for a fear of God, isn't it? The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. It's the beginning of knowledge. It's the beginning of understanding. So when you get on your knees and you ask for wisdom in handling a trial, then you're asking for the fear of God. Let's turn over to Psalm 94. And Psalm 94. We're not going to get any further than this one point today. To understand the trials, to understand the problems that we're going through, Psalm 94 is a very interesting psalm. It says, O Lord, O eternal God, to whom vengeance belongs, O God, to whom vengeance belongs, show yourself. Some of the trials that we're probably going to go through, we're going to go back to this psalm and sing it, quite frankly, because we're going to need help from God, the trials that we'll have to face. Lift up yourself, you judge of the earth, render reward to the proud. Eternal, how long shall the wicked, triumph? How long are we going to put up with what's going on in this world? How long shall they that utter and speak hard things and all the workers of iniquity boast themselves? We find that today. We find it today, and it's getting more and more the case, and it will be more and more the case. They break in pieces your people, O Eternal, and afflict your heritage. They slay the widow and the fatherless. They murder the widow and the stranger. They murder the fatherless. how many fatherless children are being murdered in the womb. They're murdering the fatherless. Yet they say, the Eternal shall not see, neither shall the God of Jacob regard it. Understand, you brutish people. So understand. Where does that understanding come from? A fear of the Eternal. That's where it comes from. Understand, you brutish among the people, and you fools, when are you going to be wise? He that plants the ear, shall he not hear? Does he not know what you're saying? Can he not understand and hear what you say? He that forms the eye, can he not see? You know, there's wisdom here. The fear of the Eternal is a beginning of knowledge. It's a beginning of understanding. It's a beginning of wisdom. The three are related. The understanding stands under the knowledge, and the active doing, it points in the direction of the wisdom, the direction of our lives that we need to go. He that plants the ear, shall he not hear? He that forms the eye, shall he not see? He that chastens the heathen, the nations. In other words, he corrects entire nations in one go. Is he not going to correct you? He that teaches man knowledge, can he not know? Can he not understand? The Eternal knows the thoughts of man, that they are vanity. There's nothing there. There's nothing within these thoughts. We're going through trials, we're going through difficulties. We've got to understand who we're dealing with, who is the one. It's a fear of the Eternal. The correct fear is the undergirding. It's the beginning of knowledge, the beginning of understanding, the beginning of wisdom. And fools, therefore, despise correction. And they say, look, you brutish among the people, you fools, when are you going to be wise? When are you going to really understand things? Blessed is the man who you chasten, O Eternal, and teach him out of your law. The wisdom, the understanding, the knowledge that is necessary, coming out of the very law of God, the Torah, the way of God, that you may give him rest from the days of adversity until the pit is digged for the wicked. In other words, we've got to go through these trials, we've got to go through these difficulties, but we can apply the wisdom that's necessary. For the Eternal will not cast off his people, neither will he forsake his inheritance, but judgment shall return to righteousness, and all the upright in heart shall follow it. It's an interesting verse, that. Judgment will return to righteousness. When Christ is going to return with judgment on this earth, he's going to return to a church that is righteous and understands righteousness. And then all the upright in heart shall follow it. Shall be after it. But the upright in heart. So the wisdom that is there should be seen by all men, at least the basic fear of God. Basic understanding among the people, that he made the ear, that made the eye, that corrects the nations, that teaches knowledge. He can go ahead and teach any one of us. But if we just go over to Proverbs chapter 1 again, and just wrap this up. It says, to give subtlety to the simple, verse 4, to the young man knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and will increase learning, and a man of understanding shall attain to wise counsel. To understand a proverb, and the interpretation of the words of the wise ones and their dark sayings. And then he comes to the first proverb of all, the first one that undergirds the whole lot, everything within the book. The fear of the Eternal is the beginning of knowledge. They say you've got knowledge, you've got understanding, you've got wisdom. And those three work together. And you find other scriptures that say the fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Eternal is the beginning of understanding as well. But fools despise wisdom and instruction. And then he goes on. He says, my son. And this is God actually speaking to each and every one of us that are going to become the very sons, the born sons of God. My son. Hear the instruction of your father, forsake not the law of your mother. Verse 10, my son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. Verse 15, my son, walk not you in the way of them, refrain your foot from the path. And he then starts to go into the book. And it is a booklet in a sense, because it's the first section, the first seven chapters, the first section of the wise ones, the sayings, the ancient sayings. And he starts to address the book of Proverbs to us on an individual basis, as a father, and so that we can become like him and be wise.